Acumen Antigo High School students. You are here with our courtroom class program. The program that is run by the State Bar and this court, in which we invite students from high schools around the state to come and observe oral argument. Students have had materials on their case and may have had counsel come and talk with them. And then they will meet at noon with the South Milwaukee High School students and will listen to and speak with a Justice Prosser. Would the students from Antigo High School stand, please? Welcome. We hope that you find this informative and interesting. You may be seated. Now that you have been introduced to the court, I would like to introduce the court to you. Starting on the far right is Justice Patrick Brooks. Seated next to him is Justice John Wilcox. To my immediate right is Justice Donald Steinmetz. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. To his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm sorry, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley.
Or Ann Walsh Prosser.
Right.
Something.
And to her left, in the far left, is Justice David Prosser. I'm going to have a sign on my bench so I don't confuse this. With those introductions finished, it's not that funny. with those introductions made, again, stay here at noon, and we will call our second case 98-0915, State v. Is it Ritter or Ryder? Ryder. Mr. Witt, you represent Mr. Ryder.
That's correct, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Michael Witt. I'm here to argue this morning on behalf of Dennis Ryder. The issue, or at least the principal issue, before the court this morning is whether the mere request to consult with an attorney can be construed as a refusal to submit to chemical testing as required by Wisconsin's applied consent law. I guess I'd like to start out by making it clear what this issue is not. This is not a challenge to the informally accused form. This is not a challenge to the sufficiency of the warnings administered. It's quite frankly not even a challenge based on 343.305. Rather, it's a challenge rooted in 94675, which is our statutory right to counsel. Legislative decision was made in this state to attach the right to counsel at the point of custody, regardless of whether the person has been charged with a crime or a forfeiture or charged with anything at all. That statute attaches the right to counsel at that point and considered it important enough to make it a misdemeanor for anyone to violate that right. This is also not a challenge to this court's prior ruling in State v. Knightson. 4 years ago, this court balanced the interest of an accused being able to consult with counsel against the state's interest in obtaining chemical test evidence, and balanced those two things out by concluding that the right to counsel did attach to an OWI suspect, but that it was not relevant to the implied consent testing procedure. In essence, I believe that ruling was that right to counsel was delayed by the implied consent procedure, but not abrogated by it. What this is a challenge to the prevailing interpretation of that case that I see quite often in trial courts around the state. Prosecutors routinely interpret and instruct police officers that, in essence, the request to speak to an attorney or an insistence on speaking to an attorney can be construed as a refusal, period. I think that that's borne out by the trial court's findings in this case. Judge Poole expressly indicated that this is something that he's starting to see fairly frequently as accused individuals become more vaguely aware of their rights, and he was troubled by the juxtaposition of his understanding of Knightson with the stature afforded to the right to counsel in the state. I think that it's also important to note that I'm not arguing that there has to be a verbal refusal. Constructive refusal is established law, both in this state and in other states. I think if you look at the cases, however, that underlie the Court of Appeals decision in Borsakowski, cases that are actually cited in a string cite in the state's brief, cases from Utah, from the state of Missouri, indicate that a constructive refusal still has to provide evidence of a volitional refusal. In this case, if there's one portion of the record which highlights the absence of a volitional refusal in this case, it's a supplemental report done by the intoxilizer officer who was going to run the test in this case, not the one who actually administered the implied consent law, but the one who, according to the testimony, tried to talk this person into submitting, trying to say, sir, if you refuse, you're going to lose your license. Don't you want to take this test? This officer wrote down, in quotation marks, what Mr. Ryder's actual response was at that time. What he said was, quote, I'm not refusing. I just want to talk to my lawyer.
Counsel, I didn't see that in your brief. Perhaps I missed it. Was that referenced in your brief? And if not, where the record is the...
It's not referenced in the brief because in the brief I relied on the trial court's findings of fact, which the trial court essentially said there's no dispute about what happened here. I find that he was denied his right to counsel, and I find that he was denied it at a time when it would have made a difference in his right to refuse. But if you look at the record, it is part of the record in this case. I believe it's 5-6D is how it was marked.
But that finding goes to something you're not contesting, as I understand it.
Absolutely.
You're not contesting the Neitzel issue.
Absolutely. And in my brief, I essentially repeated the testimony of the officer, which was consistent with that quotation written down by the other officer that night. I read Mr. Ryder the informing the accused form. He said, I want to talk to my lawyer. I reread him the form. He said, I want to talk to my lawyer. I read the form again. He said, I want to talk to my lawyer. I believe that happened 4 or 5 times. And I think that I point out that other actual quotation, just because it's so poignant, it gets so directly to the point. The officer saying, sir, sure you don't want to take this test. Your license is going to be revoked if you refuse. And the person says, quote, I'm not refusing. I just want to talk to my lawyer. And if you look at the constructive refusal case law, it all acknowledges volitional refusal still has to be a component of such a construction.
And this report that you're referencing is in the record before
us? Yes, Your Honor, it certainly is.
Did he tell anybody present what lawyer he wanted? Did he have a lawyer specifically chosen who he wanted to contact?
That's not part of this record, and I was not trial counsel, so I can't answer
that. The only reason I ask is, of course, that the police have got a limited time within which they have to take a test. And you could demand for 2 hours you want to talk to your lawyer, and you will have gone past the time for taking an effective test.
I absolutely agree with that, and I would concede that point. The trial judge also addressed this point when he found that, based on the testimony, there was certainly plenty of time to comply with the time requirements. Judge Krull made an express finding in that regard as well. I think that the cases actually that on constructive refusal, and I'm going to argue those today that more extensively than I treated them in my brief, I will concede that I was somewhat overwhelmed by the volume of authority presented by the state and chasing it all down. I felt compelled to stick in my reply to the main points. But I have read the cases, and if you look at the cases that they cite, Beck versus Cox from Utah, Spradlin versus Deneke from Missouri, Beck actually cites Spradlin, quotes it. Spradlin is a case very much like this one. Missouri law apparently has a Supreme Court rule which is analogous to our statutory right to counsel, that their Supreme Court promulgated someone in custody, regardless of whether they're charged with anything or what they're charged with, has a right to consult with an attorney. And the facts of that Missouri case are startlingly similar to Knight's, in the sense that the person was allowed to call his attorney, he was allowed to talk to his attorney, and a constructive refusal was only found after he insisted on waiting for the attorney to actually arrive before he would participate in the drug testing process. Those are the facts of Neitzel. Those are the facts of Spradling versus Dimecki, cited by the state. And those are the cases that were relied upon by our Court of Appeals in Borsakowski when they adopted the constructive refusal definition that we all use in this case law. So if you look at the constructive refusal case law in Wisconsin, it's rested on a case very similar to Neitzel, in which the court, in a state in which a person has a right to call an attorney, was allowed to call an attorney, and that court only construed it as a refusal after that person can sit there waiting for his lawyer, as Neitzel did here. I think Hellis versus South Dakota is another real nice juxtaposition of the two different sets of facts. There were two people in that case. Mr. Braunstrider's facts were very similar to those, again, in Neitzel and Spradlin. He was allowed to attempt to call his attorney, as Justice Steinmetz noted. Time was elapsing. He was concerned about the ability to get a timely test. And in viewing those facts and in balancing the right to counsel, which the federal district court in Hellis did recognize, against the public's interest in obtaining chemical test evidence, that court said, on Braunstrider's facts, he was allowed to try and call his attorney. He was allowed more than one attempt. He was allowed a lot of time to try and get this done. The officer was not unreasonable then in telling him, that if you continue to insist on waiting, we're going to mark you as a refusal. In that case, the federal district court did not find his rights to be violated. In the companion, however, Hellis, the facts are much more similar to this one. Hellis was read the implied consent warnings and said, I would like to talk to my lawyer. Gets no response.
Of what import is this, counsel? My understanding of the law is that the majority of cases that have addressed the issue have indicated, the majority of states that have addressed the issue have indicated in their cases that there is a right to contact counsel before taking the breath test. Is my understanding correct, first of all, that the majority of cases that have states that have addressed the issue have come to that?
I think that a substantial number of cases have, in different states, have adopted that position. I think the state may dispute majority. I think that there's a split among the states in how they treat it, and quite often the case law turns on specific facts, such as Spradlin in Missouri, where they had the Supreme Court ruling, or such as the case that I'm arguing today. And I think that the distinctions are there. I think it's relevant because I think that it recognizes that there is an interest in counsel. I'm not suggesting that this court should find it to be a Sixth Amendment critical stage, such as it's a trump card that is going to automatically render the implied consent law invalid.
What, in looking at cases from other jurisdictions that may be analogous and therefore helpful to us, what weight should we give to those cases that interpret the right to an attorney pre-testing differently than we do? And I understand Pennsylvania interprets it the way that we do. That is, it's a, in your words, a delayed right that is delayed until after the test is given.
I think it's very relevant in terms of the recognition that there is some limited right there, even if it's not a Sixth Amendment critical stage of bright line trumping rule. I think Roberts versus Maine, which is another federal case, unfortunately, in the First Circuit, U.S. Court of Appeals danced all around because this is Sixth Amendment critical stage. We're not going to hold as a bright line rule that the pretest stage is. But they qualified that ruling by saying that it can be under certain circumstances. We're not going to say it can never be. We're saying it's not here in this case. They went on to find a liberty interest that was protected. And I think the dissent in that case is equally instructive because I think the dissent in that case said you don't need to worry about what the substantive interest is. Procedurally, look at the Matthews versus Eldridge factors on due process. What is the interest? What's the burden on the state? Is there an easy remedy?
Now, in this case, just so I understand, your thesis is, or your argument basically, is that the officer, by not responding, was misleading your client, and therefore he did not really refuse the test. I mean, is that, I stated it correctly?
I think that was factually what occurred. I think that the problem is that the ruling in Neitzel is, as the trial court recognized, so often interpreted to go beyond its actual holding and to mean that asking for an attorney is in and of itself enough. I think that in this case, I think that it was misleading. I think that it's been my experience, and I think it's Judge Kuhl was graceful enough to put on the record that it's been his experience as well, that officers do know this. They do know, despite the fact that in any other context, when someone says, I want to talk to my lawyer, they want to get lawyered up, that that's something they have to pay attention to. But they know there's an exception in this context. They know that they don't have to let the guy call his lawyer before he blows the machine. The officers all know this.
So what do you want him to say? What do you think the officer should say?
I don't think there has to be a Miranda card bright line phrase, so please don't scribble to write this down. But I think they should say at that point when they're getting yeah, I understand this is a serious decision, I want to talk to my lawyer, and all they're getting parroted back is the same information that invoked the request in the first place, I think a simple, sir, you can't do that right now. We have to finish the testing process first. I'll let you call him when we're through, but I want to call him now. Well, you can't do that, sir, and if you don't participate in the test, I'm going to consider it to be a refusal. It doesn't have to be a beautifully structured legalese phrase. I think it should probably be avoided. I think it's just plain common sense. If you look at Neitzel, Deputy Clark, 20-some years ago from La Crosse County, had no problem communicating that in plain English to Mr. Neitzel. It was inherent in the way he conducted himself that he, just to be fair, sir, I'm going to tell you that if you insist on waiting for your lawyer to come, I'm going to consider this a refusal. And it was only in the face of that, well, I don't care what you say, I'm going to wait for my lawyer no matter how long it takes, that a constructive refusal was found. Same situation as Bradley, which is the Missouri case on which our constructive refusal cases rest. So I think that your points are well taken, and on facts where someone clearly is not, there's no other resistance, there's no unruly behavior, there's no physical problems, there's no time problems, as was in fact found by the trial court in this case, there's not a time problem, that if there's going to be a constructive refusal found, there has to be some conduct or some statement that's indicative of a volitional refusal. And, you know, and I'm sorry, I'm not refusing, I want to talk to my lawyer, it isn't a volitional refusal. It just, I don't think that it is.
I think that, well, isn't the fact that he didn't take the test, doesn't that show a volitional refusal? He didn't take the test, did he?
I don't believe that it does. What you're talking about there is the constructive refusal, but it's the facts that govern. And I think if you look at the case law underlying that, Morzakowski, Rydeski, the out-of-state cases that our Court of Appeals cited, when they reached those decisions, volitional refusal, conduct evincing a volitional refusal. I think time is a factor, as Justice Steinman's pointed out. If the person is coming up with excuse after excuse about why the officer should wait, I think it's perhaps Rydeski that's a case in point. The 20-minute observation period is up, and now I have to go to the bathroom, and oh, wait, I have to go alone, you can't go with me. That's the type of conduct from which I think you can infer an intent to delay and infer volition. In this case, you don't have it. The trial court found there was no time problem. The trial court found that all the person actually did was to say, I'm not refusing, I want to talk to my lawyer. That's not enough. And I think if you look at the purpose of the implied consent law, I think that it's also relevant to do that in making that decision. The purpose of the implied consent law, the purpose of being able to punish someone for refusing, is to foster the state's ability to get chemical test evidence. The reason that's preferred evidence is because it's objective. It's not subjective, he looked drunk to me. It's not subjective, well, why else would he refuse then? It's hard evidence.
Go ahead. I was just gonna ask, didn't Judge Krewal find that there was a refusal here based on what had occurred?
Yes, he did.
So didn't he find there was a constructive refusal?
No, I think if you look at what he actually said, he was troubled by it. He felt compelled to find it based on Neitzel. And those were close to his exact words. I don't have the transcript in front of me, but what he said, I'm troubled by the juxtaposition of these two laws. That's a paraphrase. I'm troubled by the scenario, which I see repeating itself. But I feel bound to hold that this is a constructive refusal based on Neitzel. And I think that's probably from years of seeing that position advocated by prosecutors and not challenged. I think it's also, to go back to Justice Bradley's questions, I think that wonderful arguments can be made, and certainly have been made successfully in other states, that some right to counsel should attach. But I'm trying to confine this case to the law as we have it in Wisconsin. And this is a very simple proposition. It's the law. You made it 20 years ago. I'm not here to dispute it. The officers all know it. When confronted with a situation like this, where a simple explanation to a defendant is going to be one of two things. Either the person is going to say, oh, okay, and give the chemical test evidence that, after all, is the purpose of the law, or they're going to say, I don't believe you, you're lying to me, you're an awful policeman, I'm going to wait to talk to my lawyer, in which case, if the officer's given that warning, the person can no longer complain that he wasn't aware of what was going on or that there was no balancing given to his rights.
There seems to me a kind of a blend of arguments. An argument that's being discussed thus far, part of what you've been discussing, is there was no refusal here. In fact, you referred earlier to the intoxilizer officer saying in a report, I'm not refusing. The Court of Appeals, however, focuses our attention in a slightly different context, or a slight different way. It is, must the police advise the suspect that the right to counsel does not apply in such a setting?
I think that that flows from the initial question. The issues in a refusal hearing are limited by statute. One of them is, did a refusal occur? If you accept the premise that it's not permissible to construe a request for an attorney and merely requesting an attorney as a refusal, that's the starting point. And I think that's where I'm focusing my argument, because unless we get there, we don't get past it to your question. But if you accept that as the premise and you don't provide some sort of rule, then you're going to leave a situation where the trial courts in every single refusal case where the question of an attorney comes up are going to be left to balance. Well, are the circumstances in this particular fact scenario such that there was time? Was there other objective evidence of a refusal? And I think that what the Court of Appeals focused on was the Pennsylvania Supreme Court solution, which I think is a rational one. But I think it goes back to the question. The base question is it permissible to find that merely asking for a lawyer is refusing is evidence of consciousness of guilt?
It wasn't totally clear to me. This is the way I understood your argument. And the state talks about, in its brief, both substantive and procedural due process. This is the way I understood the flow of your argument. Look, this is a procedural due process problem. I understood. I'm not sure if that's correct what you're arguing. I understood you to say, this is a procedural due process problem. I understood you to say, look, when people, unlike the Pennsylvania case, which gave Miranda, and they said in there, on the heels of Miranda, he refused to take his test. The argument I understood you to be making was, it's reasonable for a person, especially in that context, to think they have a right to an attorney, and if they don't have a right to an attorney, a notice, a procedure should be set up that says the police must advise the suspect that the right to counsel does not apply. Otherwise, for them to say it's a refusal without advising, without giving that notice, is a denial of due process. Is that your argument or isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. And I think labeling it solely as procedural is trying to put it in a box. I think that it's fine to characterize it as a procedural. I think that the right to counsel is a substantive right.
But you're not arguing right to counsel. That's not the procedural.
I'm not taking the run at Neitzel.
I'm accepting
that this court in Neitzel balanced those rights and reasonably concluded that it doesn't defeat a person's right to counsel to delay it until post-testing. This case in the Pennsylvania subsequent to O'Connell, which is cited by the state, I believe it's Mann, M-A-N-N, extended that warning to all cases. Let's not worry about whether Miranda was given. And as the Court of Appeals said in its certification, we don't see that it makes a difference either. If someone knows of the right and asserts it, it's there. What I'm trying to do, and I don't purport to be a constitutional scholar, but as I understand it, these issues are supposed to be resolved on their simplest level rather than their most complex. On the simplest level, if the court were to find that it's not proper to construe the mere request for an attorney as a refusal, then the question becomes, all right, what does the officer do when this happens? You can either leave it, as the district court had the luxury of doing in Hellis, because after all, they don't try these types of cases unless it happens on a military base. We'll balance it out on a case-by-case basis. If Ron Strider, his rights weren't violated, Hellis, he was.
And by doing that, you're arguing that we answer this case without addressing the certified question.
I think you could answer the case without addressing the certified question, and I think that if you do, you will be throwing it upon the trial courts to undertake this balancing in every single refusal case. I think that as certified by the Court of Appeals, and appropriately so, it's a good solution. I concede that my argument to them was simpler. As I understand constitutional jurisprudence, that's always the goal. Do it to resolve the challenge at the lowest level. If you simply find that it's not permissible to say that when someone merely asks for an attorney, a right that is emblazoned in the state and federal constitutions, statutory right here, it's not permissible to construe that alone as a constructive refusal, that addresses what actually happened in this case. But that leaves the law, this is a lawmaking court, in and the position of making trial judges around the state balance that out in every case. And while that may be a nice solution for federal district courts to hear these on 83 cases or in the occasional military drunk driving, I think that Pennsylvania's solution is practical. And were this court to conclude that such a solution adequately balances the rights of the individual with the state's interest in obtaining the objective evidence, I think it's a good solution. I think that's why the Court of Appeals certified in the way that they did. I don't think to resolve the case you have to go that step, but I think it's a rational resolution that doesn't throw us back in the trial.
To resolve the case, we don't have to go to that step. To make any law, we have to go to that step. Is that what you're saying?
No, I think you can make law that says Neitzel doesn't mean that asking for a lawyer is a refusal, and that a constructive refusal is a constructive refusal only if the objective evidence leads a court to conclude that it was volitional, and then you leave the trial courts to go fish in terms of when does the request for an attorney in conjunction with what else balance out against the state's right to obtain the test. The time factors recognized by Justice Steinmetz, the other excuse factors, I'll call them, that I think Justice Crooks was alluding
well,
to.
Why not keep it simple, counsel, and leave it the way it is? I'm just thinking that if we do have, we're going to advise, all right, you can advise that they have the right to counsel. Now, the next question, someone will be up here and say, well, he didn't really tell me that, he or she, and I didn't understand what he said, and they didn't give me, now I have the right, but I, as in this case, your client wanted to telephone, and I misunderstood that. I mean, these are all, what you're saying is, if you do it case by case, then it'll be all settled by the trial judge, and you won't have these come up with us again.
I guess I'm actually suggesting that it's probably not
better. I'm being a little facetious, but I'm just saying that I can see some ancillary problems.
So
but,
can I, and that's why I think that the way the Court of Appeals certified the question was appropriate. I do not think it would be an inappropriate balance to adopt a bright-line rule such as the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania did, and I think that it addresses your concerns there. I think to respond to your opening statement on that question, though, if you leave things the way it is, it doesn't address this question. Neitzel does not address this question. Neitzel was allowed to call his attorney. He was allowed to speak to his attorney. The conduct that was construed as a refusal from Neitzel was actually insisting on waiting for the attorney to get there before he would blow in the machine. In that case, this court said only that there's no Fifth Amendment right to counsel. I'm not here asserting a Fifth Amendment right to counsel. The court acknowledged the applicability of 946.75, but said it's delayed. I'm taking that as my framework. From there, I think that the O'Connell solution is a reasonable one.
Why is 946.75 even implicated? Doesn't that require that the person in custody request a named attorney?
I looked at the record in anticipation of that question as I was not trial counsel. I would argue that the trial judge found that it was implicated, and that is what I have to rely on. I actually came in and searched the record anticipating that question. I think that the best answer I give to you there is that Judge Kuhl found, as a matter of law, that the right to counsel was implicated and that the denial of it impacted Mr. Reiner's ability to make the decision. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Crawford, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. My name is Susan Crawford, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin. I don't think that the state's position and the defendant's positions in this case are really all that far apart. The state views this case as raising a broad issue. How should an officer respond to questions about legal rights or other ambiguous responses from a driver who is asked to submit to a breath test under the implied consent statute? In this case, what the driver did was to express a desire to call his lawyer when he was requested to submit the breath test. It's the state's position that the officer's response in this case sets a good standard for fair treatment of drivers
under such circumstances. And this case presents an opportunity for this court to resolve a problematic area in the context of the implied consent procedure if it approves what the officer did in this case. Now, I expect to cover the following three basic points in the course of this argument. First, I'd like to explain what the officer did in this case. Second, I'd like to explain why that approach, if it were approved by this court, would be useful to resolve similar problems under the statute. And finally, I'd like to outline the problems with what the defendant is asking this court to do. Now, what happened here is that the officer arrested the defendant for OWI, read him the statutory information that is required under the implied consent law, and requested a breath sample from him. The defendant's response was that he wanted to talk to an attorney. The defendant argues that at that point, the officer was required, as a matter of constitutional due process, to inform the defendant that he did not have a right to consult counsel during this procedure. It's the state's position that what the officer did here satisfies due process, and I have this laid out at pages 10 and 11 of my brief. What the officer did was he informed the defendant that his answer to the question, in other words, his demand to speak to his lawyer, would be deemed a refusal under the statute and would result in the revocation of his license. He then told the defendant that he needed a yes or no answer to the question, would he submit to the test. That response satisfies due process. It put the defendant on notice that if he repeated that demand for a lawyer, he would be deemed to be in refusal. And it gave him an opportunity to submit to the test, and he did not take that opportunity. It is not unfair to hold the defendant accountable for a refusal under these circumstances.
Counsel, let me interject, I guess, something that's probably not too hypothetical. Most people, as a result of watching TV, if not reading law books, believe that if you're arrested, you have a right to an attorney.
Mm-hmm.
The record doesn't indicate here whether or not Miranda was given, but I suppose it can be argued, if it was hypothetically in case, that even bolsters a person's general recognition that if you're arrested, you have a right to your attorney, you have a right to remain silent, you just turn that TV tube and you see that night after night after night. A bit of an exaggeration for emphasis. So here you've got someone that arguably thinks he has a constitutional right to an attorney because he's seen it on TV. And then you have an officer saying, in essence, no, don't have a right. Why isn't some kind of explanation necessary?
I think the answer to that is that what is necessary is that the defendant understand the consequences of his conduct under the implied consent statute. And that's why the state's taking the position that as long as the defendant knows that if he persists in making that request to counsel, that he will be deemed to be in refusal under the statute and that the penalties that go along with that will apply to him, the due process is satisfied.
What about in a state where, unlike Wisconsin, you do have the right to an attorney? And he says, I want to see an attorney, and the officer says, I'm advising you that if you repeat that request, it will be deemed a refusal.
Where there is a right to an attorney? I would assume that in those states, that if the defendant is not afforded the right that they have, whether it's under statute or under a state constitution, that that would prevent the penalties from attaching.
That wasn't a good hypothetical. What I'm searching for is a hypothetical that would be considered a reasonable request, and yet a response that, if you request that again, I'm going to mark it as a refusal. Because I'm assuming that most people would think, if they're in custody, it's a reasonable request to ask to contact an attorney.
I don't think it is that unreasonable for people to make that request. But what my position is that when the officer then tells that person What you've got to do is give me a yes or no answer to my question. Are you going to submit to a breath test? That gives the person the information that they need to know at that juncture to make the decision that is going to invoke the penalties under the implied consent statute.
Maybe.
I am understanding your position that you feel that the officer was correct here. What, I asked the opposing counsel the same thing. What problems do you see if we were to require or adopt the position of defense counsel and just indicating that just you're not entitled to it?
Right.
What do you see happening?
I think there are a multitude of problems with requiring the officer to give the driver substantive legal advice about his right to counsel. First, the statute doesn't require it, and I don't think that this court should graft additional warnings onto the statute. Second, I don't think that due process requires it, as I've just discussed. Third, there are just inherent problems in requiring officers to give legal advice. And a quick look at the Pennsylvania case law would make that amply clear. Another problem is that advising a driver that he doesn't have a right to counsel might be just as confusing for an intoxicated driver as saying nothing at all. The advice that would be required here is not a clear-cut yes or no kind of proposition. The officer would have to explain to the person that they are entitled to counsel, but that they can't consult counsel for the purposes of this decision. I think that's likely to just trigger more questions. The driver's going to say, why not? Well, why can't I call my lawyer? Or when can I call my lawyer, et cetera? It's also going to create more problems than it resolves in future litigation. There's already been a question raised about what language would have to be used. I think there's a question about when that advice would be triggered, what the remedy is going to be for a failure to advise. For example, what would happen if it's clear that the defendant never had any intent to submit to the test? Or what would be the result if the defendant does end up submitting to the test? Would the failure to advise disqualify that positive alcohol test that results? I think that there's also a big problem with creating a slippery slope here. If the court adopts the position that's advanced by the defendant, it would establish a constitutional basis for requiring officers to give legal advice that is not required under the implied consent statute. If the officer is required to explain the limits of this constitutional or statutory right, or the fact that this constitutional or statutory right does not apply, then what happens when the defendant invokes other kinds of rights? It's not too hard to imagine some other situations in which a driver might have an erroneous assumption about rights that might apply. For example, a driver could assert a privilege against self-incrimination. A driver could assert a right to remain silent when he's asked to consent to a test. He could demand that the officer produce a search warrant. Does due process require the officer to give substantive legal explanations in these situations as well? It would be hard to find a principled way to distinguish those situations. And I think that the better rule would be that if a driver attempts to invoke some kind of legal right, or asks questions about legal rights, or seeks further explanations under the statute, or otherwise gives an ambiguous response to a request for a test, fairness should require only that the officer tell the person that if the driver wants to consent to testing, he has to tell the officer that right now, and that any other response will be deemed a refusal and will trigger the penalties under the statute.
Counsel, that sounds like a parade of horribles. Really, from all those horrible things I would never want to do. But how about this? Here's the informed consent, informing the consent. Number two says, if you refuse to submit to any such test, your operating privileges will be revoked. And number three would say, consistent with Pennsylvania case, you do not have the right to consult with an attorney or anyone else prior to taking this test.
And in fact, some states' legislatures have done that. Idaho, for example,
has done that. Are they experiencing the parade of horribles that you just suggested?
I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that is. But I think that the point that can be raised is that if the legislature wanted to require that, if they see this decision in this case, and if this court were to hold that the implied consent statute does not require an officer to give that advice, they could turn around and legislatively put that into the statute, and it would be their prerogative to do so. The same as it would be their prerogative to provide some kind of a limited right to counsel in this context, which other states also have done. I think, though, if you look at the Pennsylvania cases, just as an example, that you have seen the parade of horribles come out of that state. If you shepherdize the initial O'Connell decision, you will see a list. I bet there are about 10 cases that have reached just the Supreme Court and a multitude of cases that have been litigated in the lower appellate courts precisely on those issues that I rattled off a couple of minutes ago.
This wasn't briefed. Is there any, perhaps you're not able to respond to this, is there any problem with retroactivity with regard to your opponent's position?
I would assume that if this court were to hold, and I haven't briefed this, and I don't know what the legal standard is, but I'll give it a guess that to say that if the result in this case would be that the refusal was invalid because the officer failed to advise the person of the right to counsel, then I don't see why that wouldn't attach to any other driver who currently is out there in the same situation. Is that what you're asking?
Ms. Crawford, I don't know if this has been covered in another form of question, so I've got to ask it. I apologize if you've already answered it. Does this situation change if, at the time of initially taking the suspect into custody, the person is given his or her Miranda rights? First of which is, you have a right to a lawyer.
I think that does change it.
Okay.
I think that does change the situation, because in that case, the officer has made an affirmative representation to the person that they do have right to counsel, and I think that totally changes.
Have we ever said that in a case?
No. I don't think that's come up.
But the state does agree that would create sufficient confusion.
I think if you look at the Raley versus Ohio case that the defendant relies on, it talks about the problems in terms of substantive due process of a state official telling a person, actively representing to a person that they have a certain right, and then penalizing them when they attempt to invoke that right. And I think we'd be in that situation if an officer Mirandized a person. And I don't think that officers do Mirandize a person before they give them the breath test, because they are trained and they are aware that the law does not require them to do so. So I think that the absence of a record here means that wasn't done.
I note that page 7 of the certification, a reasonable view of those certifying from the Court of Appeals in response to that question would answer it differently. They would say that the fact remains that even without the Miranda warnings, the defendant invoked his right to counsel. And we question whether this distinction makes any difference where the suspect already knows of the right to counsel and invokes it. My sense is, much like the subsequent Pennsylvania cases, the Court of Appeals at least didn't think that would make any difference. Is that a fair reading of their certification?
Sure, I think that is a fair reading of their certification, and if I could respond to it, I think that what the Court of Appeals is not properly focusing on is when this entire case is framed as, in constitutional terms, as a violation of due process, what has the state done to this person, and what has the state represented to this person? Has the state made a representation to this person that they have a right to counsel? No, that didn't happen. In fact, what the state represented to this person is, if they persist in demanding to talk to counsel, they are going to lose their driver's license. That person has to consent to the test, or any other response is going to be deemed a refusal. And I'd like to just talk for a couple of minutes about...
Can I just say?
Sure.
With television being the prime educator about legal rights, as far as I can tell, and with every police show and law show that deals with criminal law,
beginning, ending, or in the middle, there's a Miranda right. I assume that most of the students, young adults, and even older adults, can almost say the Miranda warning from memory. And so here he is in custody, right? And he asks for a lawyer, and he doesn't get any response to that. He doesn't, to that question. And he's just continually told, gotta do what the officer says in response to that. Don't you think that he thinks he's being deprived of a lawyer? And that that there's been, that he's not being treated appropriately?
Okay, I guess I have a couple of different responses to that. First, I would disagree with the characterization that the officer did not give any response to this person's request to talk to his lawyer. What the officer informed him was what his obligation was at that point in time, which was to promptly consent to the test, or if he responded in any other way, that it was going to be a refusal. Another point to make. Let me think a minute.
I thought you'd answer that just because he's mistaken about the law shouldn't bind the state.
I'm sorry?
But just because he's mistaken about his legal rights should not bind the state. He shouldn't.
I guess that's kind of the bottom line. I think also that if, you know, a reasonable. I think that the premise that is underlying the hypothetical you just gave, that when somebody asks for counsel and then they are told, if you continue to demand counsel, you're going to be deemed in refusal, and what you have to do is promptly submit to or refuse this test. I think that a reasonable person would respond to that, a reasonable non-intoxicated person would respond to that by saying, geez, I'm not going to get to talk to my lawyer here. Now, why should that person assume that the officer is misleading them about what their rights are or depriving them of a right that they actually do have or, you know, violating what that person's legal rights are? I think that the officer's response, I think that the driver's erroneous belief that he has a right to counsel and his erroneous belief that this officer is unfairly depriving him of exercising some right is not something that should trigger a constitutional duty on the part of the officer to give substantive legal advice about why exactly it is that this right doesn't attach at this point.
Could I ask for your comment on this? Mr. Witt referred to something in the record about the intaxilizer operator making notes. Could you comment on that? You say that the intaxilizer officer encouraged the man to take the test. Was there any response by the officer to that comment?
I just don't recall seeing that in the record. I guess the response, he made some response that I'm willing to believe defense counsel and say he made a response, I'm not refusing, I just want to talk to my lawyer, something like that. I actually don't think that that should change the analysis any. And the reason for that is that I think that defense counsel has mischaracterized a little bit what constitutes a refusal in this state. It is not required that a refusal be a knowing, intelligent decision. The courts have required it to be a volitional act that triggers a refusal, and that's in the context of a case that language, volitional act, arose in the context of a case in which a driver gave an inadequate breath sample a couple of times. And what the courts are obliged to determine is, you know, is that something that the person was intentionally doing or in order to avoid getting a positive test result, or is that something that they simply were physically incapable of doing? Because the statute does provide a defense if a person is physically incapable of submitting to the test. I think the term volitional is just talking about the voluntary character of the defendant's actions and not whether he intended to refuse the test or not. I think that's an important distinction to make. So in this case, even if the defendant, you know, until he was hauled off to jail, kept insisting over and over, but I want to talk to my lawyer, I want to talk to my lawyer, I don't want to refuse. Once the officer has told him, you know, if you persist in telling me that, you are going to be deemed in refusal under the statute, I think it's fair to hold him accountable for a refusal. I'd like to just point out that there are some situations where the state thinks it would be unfair to penalize a defendant for a refusal. This court has interpreted the implied consent statute as requiring a defendant to either promptly submit or promptly refuse a request for a test. Anything other than a prompt submission can be deemed a refusal under the statute. Now, under some circumstances, a defendant may lack notice that his conduct will be deemed a refusal, and it might be unfair or just unreasonable to hold that person accountable for a refusal and to impose the penalties. For example, if the officer reads the advisory and the driver responds by saying, I want to talk to my lawyer, as he did in this case, or if he says he has some question about the procedure, or if the driver just pauses to think for 5 seconds. I think it would be unfair to immediately record those responses as a refusal. The driver would probably have no idea that that conduct would be deemed a refusal and result in a license revocation. Now, I think the simple solution to these problems, and they do frequently arise, is to have the officer advise the driver that that response will be deemed a refusal and that if they want to consent, they have to do so promptly.
Counsel, I came up with an analogous situation that's in the context of Fifth Amendment assertion of I refuse to answer on the grounds that it might tend to incriminate me.
Uh-huh.
Just to say that as a kid, you know, so I think most people know that.
Right.
Almost akin to you have the right to an attorney. I mean, that's a fundamental right to get on TV.
Right. Yeah.
Let's say a person was asserting involved in a crime and was asked about that and stood there and said, I refuse to answer on the grounds that might tend to incriminate me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the attorney asking the question knows that in that state, that there is immunity that would be afforded that defendant on that question. But rather than telling the defendant, look, you have immunity, you have no problem, answer the question, rather than telling him the law on that, the attorney or the judge says, answer the question. I refuse to answer on the grounds that might tend to incriminate me. Answer the question, you go to jail. I refuse to answer on the grounds that might tend to incriminate me. Answer the question, you go to jail. Isn't that the same thing we have here? All you need is to say, look, you're immune from prosecution under a state provision. Answer the question. Oh, okay. Let me answer the question. Isn't that the same thing here?
Yeah.
I want an attorney. Answer the question, you're going to have a revocation. I want an attorney. Answer the question. All you have to say is, look, under the law, you're not entitled to an attorney at this stage. Oh, okay. What's the difference?
I think the difference is, it's really hard to get a grip on that hypothetical. That hypothetical is really similar to what happened in Raley versus Ohio. In that case, there were witnesses who were brought up against some commission against anti-American activities or something like that in the 50s. And they repeatedly asserted a privilege against self-incrimination in response to the questioning. As it turned out, later on, and no one told them, and in fact, they were explicitly told that they could assert their Fifth Amendment rights in that context. It turned out that there was an immunity statute, and then they were prosecuted for refusing to answer questions that they had immunity for. And I think that the difference is that in this case, well, there are so many differences in this case, but I think the essential difference here is that the officer is giving the defendant the essential information that he needs to know, which is, you know, if you tell me that again, that you want to talk to a lawyer, I'm going to write this down as a refusal on this form.
If you tell me again you're going to refuse to testify, you're going to jail.
Say seems... But you're talking about a situation where that person, in fact, has immunity. I guess the difference would be is that if in this case the person actually did have a right to counsel and the officer was lying to him and telling him that he didn't, or implying to him that he didn't by telling him he had to make a decision by himself here, that, you know, there would clearly be a different result. If there were a right to counsel in this context, that would be a different situation, and that's not what we've got going on here.
Well, counsel, your proposal makes some sense. But it is, your proposal is not covered under the informing the accused form. So your proposal would add something to it also.
I recognize that. It does add a little bit to it, but it doesn't add anything in terms of requiring the officer to give substantive legal advice outside of the context of the statute. All it does is requires him to reiterate what we know, which is you've got to make a prompt decision here to consent to the test. And if you don't do that, you're going to be held in refusal. And I agree that it's not something that the statute specifically addresses, but we see, you know, the Court of Appeals sees dozens of cases every year in which drivers are confused, they're asking questions, they're being ambivalent, they're being indecisive, and officers have a really hard time dealing with those situations, and this would give them a way to deal with it.
So what should be added then to the informing the accused under your argument?
I actually don't think it has to be a sort of mantra of, some kind of specific language.
But isn't it best when you're dealing with this kind of bread and butter issue to have it uniform? Maybe I'm wrong. I was just following up with Justice Babbage.
I think the substance of what the officer should say, and I have this at a couple of different pages on my brief, on page 27 and 30. The substance of what the officer should say, and this is something that the officer should only be doing if he hasn't gotten either a prompt consent or a prompt refusal, okay? Not something that you would have to tell them at the outset, but after you get some kind of an ambiguous response, tell them that response will be deemed a refusal, and if you want to consent, you have to do so promptly.
But all the defendant is asking is that you add a few more words.
Right, but the few more words that he's asking are really the problem. Like I said at the outset, I don't think there's that much distance between what I'm saying and what the defense attorney is saying here.
You don't have a right to an attorney, and if you continue to persist in these answers, I will take this as a refusal. That's what he's asking.
And then in the next case, we're going to have somebody saying, but that wasn't true. It wasn't that I didn't have a right to an attorney. I was in custody. I did have a right to an attorney. And what he didn't tell me was I didn't have a right to an attorney for the purposes of deciding, et cetera, and on down the line. It's not quite that simple. And I think that it would be the easiest thing and the most sensible thing and the fairest thing to follow the recommendation that the state's making. There are no further questions. The state respectfully asks this court to affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Mr. Whitt.
To respond to that last exchange, the case that counsel is hearing will come back before this court isn't the next case. It's the last case. You already decided that question where someone came here and said, I have a substantive right to counsel, and you said, no, it doesn't attach at this point. It's delayed. That's not some horror story that's going to happen. That's not the next case. That's the last case. That's not going to be any consequence of adding a requirement that a person be told they don't have a right to an attorney. Quite frankly,
do we need to find the due process problem in order to instruct officers to do that, or can we ground it on some other authority?
I think that you could ground it on some other authority that you have, a rulemaking authority. I think that you can make it a due process problem without making it a bright line problem. Again, I don't purport to be a constitutional scholar, but as I understand due process analysis, whether it's procedural or substantive, the end point is fundamental fairness. If I can be permitted a crude analogy, if you have a dead fish in front of you and you close your eyes, you can tell it's a dead fish. No matter how the most creative sushi chef in the world chops that dead fish up and rearranges it on the plate so it looks like a work of art, you close your eyes, it still smells like a dead fish. That's the fundamental fairness test. I'm not going to quibble over language.
That's
I think that's the basic argument I'm making here. I'm trying not to get overcomplicated, not to delve off into complicated theories. I think that your retroactivity question, I think the response 10 cases is a lot of cases is coming from appellate experience. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of these things that trial judges have to deal with every day throughout the state. Adding the requirement that someone be told, you don't have a right to an attorney right now, if you persist in asking for one, I'm going to deem it a refusal, will eliminate all of those litigations. You've already ruled in Knightsville that the substantive right doesn't exist. Add that requirement. If the officer says the magic words, I don't see that spawning litigation. I see it cutting it. The Court of Appeals, when it certified this case, and I believe it may have been in a footnote, but they searched the record for times this has been raised previously. And it's interesting that there's a high school group from Antigo here, because it was a case that was decided out of Antigo. I represented the defendant in that case 4 years ago. That's the only other case the Court of Appeals could find where an issue similar to this was raised. So in terms of retroactivity, yes, if someone else out there had facts like this where they did nothing else which could be construed as a refusal, simply asked for a lawyer, maybe it's going to apply to them. But otherwise, I think that those circumstances are sufficiently prescribed that the benefit that you would provide to trial courts from this ruling is greatly outweighed by any additional 8 to 10 horror story Pennsylvania cases. I think that your example of the defendant is not just Raley, it's United States versus McDonough. That's again a case cited by the state. It's a Fifth Circuit case, I believe. The whole concept that volition is something other than a knowing refusal, the case that counsel refers to is Borzakowski. That case is rested on Beck and Spadling, the Utah and the Ohio, or Missouri case that I talked about earlier. Cases which talk about issues very much like this, at least in the Missouri case, and argue that it has to be volitional in the sense that the person is intending to refuse, not just that they're volitionally knocking over the water glass and giving the officer a hard time, not that that couldn't be a constructive refusal, but I don't think you can whittle away volition the way the state wants to do that. I'm relying on the cases that they cited. Borzakowski relies on Beck and Spadling. I think that the other thing in terms of fairness, even if it's too crude and simplistic, fundamental fairness is probably the fish test, whatever you want to call it, is what it's going to come down to. These are not easily understandable things. If you look at the volume of litigation that's been generated over the implied consent warnings in the state already, I don't think it's unreasonable for a person, impaired or not, in that situation, to think that they need to consult a lawyer about this decision. Operating under the influence is what I would call an equal opportunity defense. You can have people who would never have anything to do with a theft or an assault or an illegal drug transaction arrested and accused of having that one drink too many. In that setting, it is not unreasonable to ask for an attorney. I don't think it's unreasonable for the officers to be required to tell them what they already know, what this court said 20 years ago. No, sir, that's not applicable yet. I'll let you call them when we're through here. That's not unreasonable.